Lobby matter. Do we have Mr. Mosley and Mr. Rajali on the line?
Mr. Mosley here.
Mr. Rajali here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Mosley, you have 15 minutes. Did you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No, I don't think I will. There's very little time.
Are you on a cell phone or a?
I am. Would it help? I have been listening. Is it better now?
Yeah.
You're actually going in and out a little.
All right. Maybe I hope. I hope that will improve.
I think I can hear you better.
All right. So if I will jump in.
You can begin.
I think there are three main themes. I think that in the short time we have here, I'd like to to focus on. Although of course the client cares about all the issues raised in the proceeding, but the first thing is whether, in terms of the jurisdiction of the court, actual bona fide resident and domicile are the same or how they interact. And the second,
Mosley,
I think it's...
I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument, but while you're bringing that argument up, let me ask a question about that.
Okay.
It appears from your answer to the complaint for the divorce, as well as your cross-complaint, that you admit or your predecessor admitted that the residency and domicile was not an issue. Aren't we bound by that?
It is true that previous attorney in filing the prosecution did make that representation, but the appellant then filed a motion challenging jurisdiction and had a whole one-day hearing on May 8th. 2017 about it. So,
the statute only requires one party to be a resident of Virginia. Is there any question? Was it ever suggested that the defendant in the case, the husband, was not a resident of Virginia?
He returned to live in the District of Columbia. The evidence showed in the transcript.
The husband.
Yes.
But his complaint says that he was a bona fide resident prior to the filing.
I believe that was the case. Yes,
doesn't that confer jurisdiction on the court?
Well, if it's true, I believe that the court says that jurisdiction, the Supreme Court and this court said that the parties cannot contrive jurisdiction or waive it. And as I said, he then subsequently had a full hearing before Judge Carroll on the question of jurisdiction and held an evidentiary hearing. So he withdrew that. The circuit court contemplated the question of jurisdiction in a rather major part of the case. So actually, that was his position. So. I don't know if that answers if I should proceed.
Go ahead.
The appeal on the question is mainly whether actual bona fide residence and the very familiar concept of domicile are the same or how they interact. And I think Hiles v. Hiles, H-I-L-E-S versus H-I-L-E-S, is really nationwide about the only thing that I found that really speaks to this, which is 164 Virginia 131. Also, I wanted to mention, this is not in our brief, but a familiar concept that porting from Toomey versus Toomey, 251 Virginia 168, the jurisdiction for a divorce is limited to the terms of the statute. It does not exist, at least for equitable distribution, it says. That it's a matter of statute and not of common law, so it has to strictly comply. But I found hundreds of cases that reference actual bona fide residence. Few of them define it. Some of them use it loosely in different ways. But in Virginia, our statute requires both domicile, a very familiar concept, and the actual bona fide resident as two prongs of the same statute. So the question becomes, are those terms redundant? Or do they mean slightly different things? And Hiles v. Hiles is the one that I think best, really the only thing, and most of the only thing I found nationwide, although it's referenced again in a case that's also cited, I believe Adoche versus Adoche, I don't know how to pronounce it, the 527 Southeast 453, that quotes extensively and relies upon House v. House. So it becomes a, there's also authority that, the, it's mentioned in Adoche versus Adoche on page 2 that the determination of domicile and bona fide residence is a mixed question of law and fact reviewable on, appeal. So the question of law is whether, in this case, for example, having been in Virginia and living in Canada, the presence, the actual physical presence is sufficient. In Hiles, in both cases, it was not. But I think both cases explore the fine distinction. Here, I think where the court got it wrong was that the court referenced that the parties things stored in a room, and I think the judge ignores the fact that the house was leased for 2 years, which is let's see, that's on the that's on 783 of the appendix. In the transcript, where it was testified that it was leased, and there was also testimony that it was put up for sale. So I think it is true that.
Let me interrupt just a minute. Wasn't the judge, it's Judge Annunziata, wasn't the judge examining the evidence in support of the party's intent with respect to both domicile and residency?
I would agree with that, yeah.
Yes, and so you're that's the question of fact aspect of the issue, is it not? And unless you can say there wasn't evidence to support it, reasonable and credible, I hear all your holes in the argument, in the continuity of the rationale. I mean, yes, they were renting a house and they kept. Stored items here and there, and they went back and forth. There was also testimony with respect to intent. So, trying to determine how level. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry. I'm
I would partly agree. I think you know their intent is, whether it's physical presence, of course, is a question. But I also think that in applying that, I don't think the circuit court addressed the two prongs of the statute. So, or considered the facts in light of. Both requirements. So, yes, what the intent was and what their physical presence was, it would have to be considered a question of fact. But I don't think the court looked at the fact that there are two parts to the law. And
can I go back to an earlier question I had? Where was the husband living 6 months prior to the filing of a lawsuit?
In one of the residences in, the District of Columbia, which is also
not in Virginia.
Right.
When was the last time he lived in Virginia?
Before they left Canada to Canada.
They were in Canada together.
Yes, they were. Yes, most of the time they were in Canada since 2013, and they returned. I think unloaded the U-Haul in. Great Falls. Then he, then she went to Iran, and he went to the District of Columbia. Then she came back to Great Falls, and lived in their house there.
Mr. Mosley, this is Judge Malvo. I'm going to circle back to the question I asked earlier, which is in reference to pleadings. You're an experienced attorney, and when you're dealing with pleadings, obviously there are things that are concessions that you can make in those pleadings. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And in reference to the issue of residency or whether somebody is a domicile, those are factual determinations. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And those, and so if, in fact, in a pleading, those are conceded, notwithstanding whether something is heard later, what is the court to do with that concession?
Well, I think Judge Carroll, in her hearing, referenced one of your cases that where the pleading was not determinative, and that's why she held a whole day hearing on it. But I think that I would interpret as I was not an attorney at this time, that the appellant withdrew that and sought to amend it. It happened. I mean, the record is what the record says. But his later proceedings were to withdraw that and says that's not what my attorney had filed there was not correct.
But you would acknowledge and again, that in order to actually have a change in the pleadings, there would have to be some sort of amended pleading filed and accepted by the court.
That would have been ideal. But there was, again, the court proceeded with a whole day hearing on the question of jurisdiction. So although I was not there at that time, the court considered that to be an issue to be resolved.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. That answers my question.
Okay. I mean, it is what it is. So the question, the issue that I have is that, but we believe that here with the house was put up for sale, which is simple, is a necessary issue legally. The other thing is a lot of the cases nationwide and in Virginia talk about abode, just assuming that it's obvious what an abode means. And it's actually the Moran case in the contract registration, some of these cases are nationwide using this phrase. They define an abode as someplace you can actually go tonight. So if you own property, but couldn't actually go there because somebody else is living there, it wouldn't qualify as an abode in terms of having physical presence there. Now, that's difficult, but considering time is short, another major issue, of course, is the fact that after the equitable distribution was over, the appellant discovered that there had already been an Iranian case on the same issue. This came down to stability under the statute. There was the court suspended a judgment and held a hearing on this after discovered Iranian court order. This was a difficult hearing with a lot of objections about hearsay, but eventually on pages 20 and 21 appellant's brief, they identify what finally came out through that portrait hearing that the question is whether or not it was certified is difficult because it's another country, stamps and seals and language. But the testimony was that Mr. Korbaya is obtained a certification in the court and the case the certification had other governmental certified as well. So there's a question of that. I think that it should have been admitted. It should have been considered for the purpose of res judicata on the equitable distribution part of the case, and also in terms of factors to be considered in equitable distribution. A transfer of gold coins in the neighborhood of $500,000 to $700,000 is a fact that should have been considered. The court did, and the judgment, to take a look at this information, but then not address it. At one point, Judge Brody says, "Believe me, I get it." She's saying it so many times. She did never, the assets and liabilities of the parties never addressed whether that had been commingled. The issue of commingling is that the inheritance tax is paid out of marital assets, and Ms. Bayai's inheritance should have been at least classified and possibly divided or could have given a paid to allow her to receive the inheritance. So I believe that those factors, you know, the court has the great discretion in contribution, but I think it's been the position of this court that the job actually must be done. There must actually be a consideration of each act. So while the circuit court may not substitute its own about what the distribution should have been, the court will reverse if the job was just not done completely. And of course, other issues that we continue to believe in, I imagine I must be at the end of my time.
You still have about a minute. But be aware that we're having a little bit of difficulty hearing. You're going in and out a little bit. So you can, in that minute time, get to a better reception site. It would be advisable.
Well, no, this is, I mean, I'm just outside of Washington, D.C., so it should be any better. In any event, so yes, we think that the court needs to consider, I think it would be important in general, whether the statute giving jurisdiction for divorces has one prong or two, and what, you know, whether, I think the statutory construction requires that every part of a statute be construed to mean something rather than nothing, as in the Red River Ash case. And so I think that's something that's useful to be clarified and important. Also throw in one other thing, if you can hear me.
Mr. Mosley, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Rajali?
Yes, good afternoon. Fred Rajali, representing the appellee, Christine Purbabai, in this matter. May it please the court, this is going to come before you, and I'm going to go through the issues, and if I get stopped at some point, then I assume that that is the issue that you want me to discuss. So this comes before this court on appeal on a number of issues, the first one being custody and visitation, second being jurisdiction, third is the equitable distribution, and then finally we have the denial of the motion for a res judicata and additional evidence to be presented to this court. Just to give you a brief background, I know the court is familiar with that. The complaint in this case was filed on the 15th of December 2015. It alleged a separation date of December 1, 2015. However, it did allege additional fault grounds. What is important, I think, and the court touched on it, was that there was no denial of this particular jurisdiction by the defendant in this case, by the appellant now. There was a counterclaim filed alleging jurisdiction at that point, and it went on until he filed a motion to go ahead and challenge it. On that particular issue, if you would, Judge, there are two hearings in this case. Remember, we had a full-day hearing in this case on the issue of jurisdiction, and then at the equitable distribution trial, the court again had to determine the jurisdiction and make a separate finding on the jurisdiction based on independent information. What is of importance is that at that second hearing, there was also a corroborating witness who testified in the case. The testimony of that corroborating witness was not part of the appendix that I could find. So I submit to you that as far as the appendix is concerned, there are information that is missing on this particular case. As far as the information that is relevant and are in the appendix, which I think are important for the court to consider, is that both domicility and bona fide residency in this case was established. Judge Shen, who heard the issue on the – and I'm sorry, I heard a beep going off, and I'm – trying to make sure that that's not something that has to do with me. Who take that issue into consideration, specifically cited Hiles v. Hiles in her decision, Judge Carroll, I'm sorry. And Judge Carroll is citing Hiles v. Hiles, says that plaintiff need not to have been physically present in Virginia every day during that period, but it said that during that part of that year, he who is absent, he is actually maintaining good faith in locality somewhere in Virginia as his personal permanent abode. And if you look at the testimony that was presented to this court, the house in Sunnybrook that the parties testified about it, they both testified, I mean, she testified, and I think that the court can take either one of them as credible, that they were receiving their utility bills there, that they were receiving their mail there, that they maintained a room. Everybody refers to that room as a room where they stored their property, but the testimony actually was that they maintained a room, and in it that was their personal property. So there's clear evidence. They both filed taxes in Virginia that claimed that they were residents of Virginia. Counsel now is making an argument that his client was living in the District of Columbia. He had a Virginia driver's license. If he was in the United States, his driver's license was Virginia. Those are evidence that the court can take into consideration in determining whether or not he was living in Virginia. He filed taxes in Virginia, stating Virginia was his residence. Now he's coming in and saying, no, actually, I was living in the District of Columbia. The credibility of the witness when it comes to that is important, and I think that, Judge Carroll was correct in determining that that they need not be need to be physically present here, but that they had to have maintained an abode and that there was no intention, that this was a temporary sojourn. So I think that that was done correctly. And again, like I said, Judge Brody, in her determination of the equitable distribution trial, again, separate and independent of the testimony of the witnesses, established that there was jurisdiction. Something that, you know, at that time, like I said, the transcript of that particular testimony was not included in the appendix of this appeal. And if you can look at the appendix on pages 560, 658 through 757, you see that that, I'm sorry, 757, you see that that particular transcript has been redacted by Mr. Mosley. So I think that, that burden is on him. Now, when it comes to custody, I think that the case is even more lopsided than it is on the issue that Judge Carroll determined. Judge Shannon held the custody hearing on the 7th of 8th of February of 2017. Both parties testified in detail in that case. Both parties presented the court with exhibits in that case. And more importantly, there was plenty of evidence, despite what the counsel has tried to indicate, that the children were subject to abuse by Mr. Purbabai. And this record of this case is replete with that. If you look at page, I think, 114 of the appendix, you can see a video being played, and in that video, at least there's an allegation made. Again, the video itself did not find its way to the Court of Appeals, but you can look at the contents of what is alleged is in that video, and then of course all the references to my client that were made in the presence of the children, those are all there as well. The more important part is that this particular order was not objected to when it was entered. So if you look at the custody order that was entered in this case, there is no objection made to it, and I don't think that the Court of Appeal would consider a particular case without proper objection having been made to that particular issue. So I think that that is important for the court to determine. Now, when
Mr. Rajali,
to yes,
this is Judge Malva. Do you want to speak to the living separate and apart for the year period, given the fact that the pleading was filed in December and there's the allegation of an October separation of the same year?
And, Your Honor, if there is, in fact, a grounds for divorce at the time that the pleading is filed, and this pleading was filed both on fault and no-fault grounds, that always can be orally amended, and there can be a divorce based on the separation of 1 year and apart, even though it didn't exist at the time of the filing.
Well, it appears in this case, even though it's not reflected in the order, that the amendment was done orally. Is that correct?
That must be the case, Your Honor. Again, like I said, unfortunately, the record of this case is not complete, but yes. So if I may go forward, if that question has been answered.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. When the issue of a res judicata was brought up with this court, the only order that was presented to this court was an order that was drafted in Farsi. There was no translation of that submitted to the trial court. So now you have a court that is provided with a document that is in a different language and not properly authenticated. Section 8.01-391B of the Code of Virginia requires all foreign documents to be properly authenticated. This was not, and the court correctly held it out. But what is more important is that when we get to the doctrine of committee and honoring foreign orders, we look at a number of things. One of the things we look at is whether or not, you know, the laws of a different country are similar to what we have here, and I submit to you that that's not an issue that was discussed in this case, but we are talking about the laws of Iran versus that of the United States. But what is important is whether or not that foreign country had jurisdiction over the people. And in this particular case, even
let me interrupt just a minute. The fact that it wasn't admitted for the reasons that you initially mentioned, doesn't that end the inquiry? The issue of comedy and all that would come up, had to be reviewed in terms of how much credence to give the order. But I don't think the order was ever admitted or considered, was it?
It absolutely does, Your Honor, but, you know, I have been always of the opinion that I only not only make the legal argument, but the equitable one behind it as well. So, yes, you're absolutely correct. As far as law is concerned, that right there ends any discussion on this particular topic.
And I appreciate that what you're trying to do. I just want to be sure my understanding of the law is still sustained. You know, that basically once that ends the issue. I see it was either erroneously admitted or not, and your view is that it was not erroneously kept out for the reasons you gave.
No, Your Honor, and the court has, you know, broad authority over that, and, you know, even if it didn't, this was pursuant to a very narrow statute, and it didn't meet any of the requirements of that statute. So now we get to the issue of equitable distribution and counsel's argument that, you know, the factors of equitable distribution were not taken into consideration by the trial court. And again, here we have an issue with the transcript of the particular hearing missing where, you know, Judge Brody made her ruling. She referred us back to court. She made the transcript on the record. There was a transcript of it made. That transcript never found its way into the record of the Court of Appeals. So we have no way of knowing whether or not any factors were considered when she put them on the record. The final decree itself, however, on its face, says that all factors of 20-107.3 have been considered. And the court again has, the Court of Appeals have a lot of decisions. I can cite to Zip versus Zip, 8VA App 387, that says that there's no requirement for the court to specifically articulate the finding required by the court, although a statement of such findings are preferable. And again, if there was a statement of such findings made, we don't have a record of it because there was not one put into the record of this appeal. Again, citing Woody versus Woody, 3VA App 337, even though the trial court must consider all statutory factors in fashioning the award, it is not required to articulate the weight which it is given to each factor. Fashioning of an equitable distribution award is within the sound discretion of the trial judge, and it will not be set aside unless it's plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. That I'm actually quoting from Srinivasan versus Srinivasan, which is 10VA App 728. And in this particular case, I don't think that there is any evidence that would in any way, would point to that particular statute or to that particular issue. Judge, the other issues that were brought up, I'm just looking at some of the issues that were brought up, is that there was a motion to reopen the case and to present new evidence, and that was based on the fact that counsel argued that at the end of the equitable distribution case, Mr. Purbabai wanted pro se to enter additional evidence into the record. Well, Your Honor, the fact in this matter is that at that point, the case had closed. Both parties had presented their evidence. Everybody had done what they were supposed to. And Mr. Purbabai fired his counsel and showed up for the closing arguments by himself. His counsel was there, but he showed up for the closing arguments, arguing that he wanted to make the closing arguments. In the closing arguments, as so many pro se litigants do, he was referring to evidence that was not there and attempting to close on evidence that did not exist and was not there. At that point, when he did that a number of times, is when Judge Brody actually stopped him and pointed out to him that he can't do that. And when he continued to do that is when Judge Brody asked him to sit down and basically deny him of his right to speak. The bottom line on that particular case is that...
Judge Murphy, let me just ask this question. as I record, it was to present some 100. He wanted to have admitted, but which had been rejected the day before the closing argument.
It was 116 pieces of evidence that was not presented the day before, and is not part of this record so much as I can tell. It was not in the.
He wasn't as I understand. Well, I thought he had asked to have them, but in any event, there was a ruling on it, and he was not permitted to have them admitted into evidence. And he wanted to have a hearing on the issue, but. And again, restated that the evidentiary hearing had been concluded. And then he
went on. Yes, Your Honor, not to interrupt you, but the opportunity to present evidence at that point had come and gone, entirely come and gone. This was just for closing arguments. And at this point, you try and bring in evidence, and if the judge shuts you down a number of times, at that point, the judge has the discretion to run the court, the way he wants. I think the law says, and again, I'm quoting common law, Ortiz versus Commonwealth, when viewing the decision of the trial court as to admissibility of evidence, Virginia courts apply a standard of abuse of discretion. Yes.
Mr. Rajali, thank you for your argument. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted, and we will be in touch shortly.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Everyone have a nice afternoon.